Welcome to the Star Coalition podcast. My name is Luke Kramer, Executive Director of the Star Coalition. So glad to have you here with us today, where we love to sit down and chat with some of the greatest minds in advocacy, research, and treatment of those living with central nervous system disorders such as schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, and other indications. And we are honored today to have with us Dr. Elon Cohen. Dr. Cohen is the lead psychometric rater and principal investigator for Hassman Research Institute. Since 2007, he's conducted phase 1 through 4 CNS and medically focused clinical trials. And Dr. Cohen has over 20 years of robust experience providing high standard of direct clinical care to individuals living with a variety of psychiatric disorders. His expertise also extends to the psychiatric scale management services and also writing clinical trial protocols, integrating regulatory compliance matters with rater training programs, and producing various scale training videos. He's on the cutting edge of important topics that are affecting the research industry, and some we're going to talk about today. So thank you today for being with us, Dr. Cohen. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be talking with you. And your esteemed listeners.
Oh, thank you. Well, for some folks that may not know, can you tell us more about what is a psychometric rater and a principal investigator for a clinical research site?
Yes, absolutely. So when a patient, so they're not subjects yet, or what we like to call participants, when they come into a site, they're going to be interacting with various staff that are involved in the study, in the clinical trial, one of which will be the principal investigator, as well as definitely a psychometric rater. And so the principal investigator will start with that individual because they're sort of the pinnacle of the trial at the site. I don't like hierarchy, but sort of that's where we have to start. They are the overseer of the trial at the site. They are ultimately responsible for the adequate, high-quality conduct of the study. So any staff that are in charge of procedures, that the principal investigator, or what we call PI, has to make sure that they're qualified, that they're via their experience, their education, their procedures, that everything is done correctly per the protocol. And real fast, a protocol is sort of our Bible. It tells us step by step all the rules for how to conduct that trial. And the PI, again, is in charge of making sure that everything is done per that that protocol. When the FDA comes, they occasionally will come to the site to audit. The sponsor or the pharmaceutical company will come and audit the site's work on that study. It is ultimately the PI's responsibility to make sure that it was done right. And if it wasn't done right, they're actually written up. It's sort of called a Form 483, we call it in the industry. And that is sort of like a big no-no. We don't want that. And certainly at our site, we don't have that, so we're good. knock on wood. But it's sort of our fear. So we always want to make sure that that's done correctly. Then the psychometric rater reports to the PI, because it's one of the roles of the study. And we, I'm a rater, so I'm a little biased, but we're sort of we are the crucial part of the trial because we conduct the efficacy scales of that study. So let's say for depression, there are certain instruments that the protocol says the subject, we're going to look to see that the participant improves or not improves on this instrument. Let's say for depression. And the rater administers that instrument, that scale, to the participant to see if they're better, worse, or the same. So it is our work. It's our calibration to make sure that we're doing that scale per our training. We're doing it correctly with high quality. And once we're done, those scores go into a system. And at the end of the study, it's all analyzed to see how the drug that's being experimented on did.
You know, it's a tremendous amount of data flows in and out. You know, having done so much time in direct care, right, with individuals who are living with psychiatric disorders, moving into the research area, I'm sure that you've had, obviously, a lot of direct contact with folks that are living with symptoms. And I just kind of want to stay on this for a second. So, there is stigma involved with, you know, mental health and CNS disorders. There's also stigma involved around research. But, you know, we're really ultimately wanting to increase participation because we know with cutting edge scientific research, we can begin to find ways that individuals can live, hopefully with fewer symptoms and live a fulfilling life. But of all the people that you've seen over years, are there any, what makes a good subject or patient or volunteer, what are some of the qualities that, that people may have to go into a trial that, that you find that are helpful, that are good?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking it. In no particular order, but certainly crucial, is a participant who tells us the truth, who really understands their symptoms and can tell us exactly what they're experiencing, what they're feeling, whatever during the time frame of that interview. We don't want people coming in with high expectations, and I think we're going to discuss placebo and nocebo effect. And expectation bias, which again we'll go over, is the big producer of a placebo effect, and we do not want a placebo effect in our clinical trials. And so a participant who comes in saying, I can't wait to start this, this is going to be great, this is definitely going to help me, we don't want that. We want to neutralize that expectation because we don't know in many of our trials, majority of our trials, if you're going to get the active medication or the placebo, which again we'll discuss. And moreover, we don't know if the actual medication actually works. That's why they're doing the study, to find out if that actual medication works. So truth-telling is crucial, very important. The other thing they need to really do, and we do this with our in our trials, with all of our placebo-controlled trials, is they have to understand the difference between active medication and a placebo. So at the end, when we go over this, we ask them to go back, tell us back again, so what is a placebo and what does it mean? Basically, it means that we're blinded, nobody knows what we're on, and you're not going to be disappointed if me, the participant, is better, worse, or the same, and that there are no expectations. Other great participants, they show up for their appointment. Each study has a visit, has several visits, and those visits, depending on the study, have windows that those visits are allowed to be conducted. Some studies don't even have a window. In other words, you have to come in on this date. Some allow a 3-day window, some allow 2 or even 1 day. So if you don't show up, it's often then you can't continue in the study. If you're late for a particular study visit, that's it, if you're not within that window. Another big thing is compliance. Taking the medication.
Right.
Your audience may be surprised to know that the research shows that about 30% of individuals do not take the study medication. That is awful. It ruins the study. And some studies even test for that at the end. They will test their blood. Sometimes at the beginning or the end. And we do find in general about 30% of folks do not take their meds. That's not good. We want subjects or participants who really take this seriously and are going to take the medication that we give them. So I think another important piece to being a, quote, good participant is that they understand that it's important that they flex in terms of their time. So I'm back-to-back with research participants, as well as patients before they even get into a trial. And so they may come up with issues that they're experiencing that I need to immediately address. I guess a good example would be suicide ideation that we take very seriously, understandably. And so I would have to deal with that before I see the next research participant or patient. And so, you know, the individual may have an appointment for 9:30, but I can't see them till later, slightly later, like 10-ish, as an example, mm-hmm. because I have to address that other issue. And we don't want people to get extremely frustrated and say, well, I'm out of here, I'm done. We want them to understand that we give them as much attention just as we did the other, as we do the other subjects or participants. I think another important piece is, and Luke, you mentioned this very wisely, is the stigma, not only of having a psychiatric disorder mm-hmm. in our culture, but also maybe being a research participant, you know, the whole guinea pigs. So a good participant sort of understands that certainly the industry, the site staff, do not view them in any way as a guinea pig. We hold them in high esteem, respect, with empathy, not sympathy, but with empathy, and so greatly appreciate their time and what they're putting into developing new compounds, new medications to help individuals suffering from those illnesses.
You know, you brought up so many great points. One thing that seems to be a theme that I hear quite often, mostly from sites who go that extra mile with a patient, is building that trust. Mm-hmm. For many folks, they may not be used to be able or be comfortable to talk openly about the symptoms that they're experiencing. A lot of times they're told not to talk about those things or, you know, kind of suppress those things. So I'm sure that there is a level of trust that needs to be built between you and that particular participant. But some of the stats that you said are really amazing. 30% of individuals do not take their medication. Obviously, there are a lot of variables that go in. And so obviously the job of a psychiatric rater is pretty difficult. You have to be very observant and be present, really, with every single person that you're with. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that you have studied a lot about the placebo and nocebo effect. I'll just want to talk about that, especially with brain disorders. And I know that a lot of you and other team members from Haspen Research, the science division, have really been working tirelessly to try to research methodologies to reduce the placebo mm-hmm. and nocebo effects with clinical research. Can you explain a little bit about the placebo and nocebo effect, and what have you and your team discovered through your research?
Oh, thank you. Another great question. Thank you. Just to back up a bit, what is a placebo and what is a nocebo effect? So it came from Latin. So in Latin, placebo is, quote, I will please, and nocebo is I will harm. So in essence, a placebo effect, which is the killer of our clinical trials globally, mm-hmm. In other words, a compound cannot get to market when we have a high placebo or nocebo effect. And in essence, what they are is a placebo effect is the research participant is getting a placebo. A placebo is, quote, a sugar pill. Now, we do get a lot of participants say, well, I'm diabetic, I don't want to get sugar. So it's not actually sugar. It's okay. It's not actually sugar in the pill. It's just a sugar. It's called that way. It's a blank. We call it a blank nothing pill. It's just nothing. It will cause no benefit and cause no side effects. So a placebo effect is when you get this pill, but the research participant says, oh my God, I'm feeling so much better. This is amazing. What is this? That will kill the drug, the compound that we're trying to get approved by the FDA. Because you're saying it's just as good as those people who are actually getting the medication. So then why is the actual medication even helpful? Now, the nocebo effect is the opposite. It's you're getting a nothing medication, but you report having side effects, getting worse, not in terms of symptoms, but having side effects. So what we call in the industry, adverse events. So you're getting this nothing thing. You're saying, you know what, since you gave me this pill, I'm getting headaches or I'm feeling nauseous, when in fact they should be feeling any different because they're getting a nothing medication. Hmm. So we know in our research in the industry that placebo effect happens about 30-ish, 40% of the time, which is pretty bad if you really think about it. You're getting this nothing medication, and trials are failing at a rate of 30-ish, 40%. I mean, it's even been rated, depending on the study, at 60%. The nocebo effect is about 20, 25% of the time is what happens with the nocebo. And what we're trying to do, certainly at Haspen Research Institute, is what can we do to lessen, to mitigate the placebo effect? Now, notice I didn't say to stop the placebo and nocebo effect. I think it's just a human phenomena that you're coming to a clinic and you're getting some level of attention, and that's important while I'm on that, if I may. It is different attention being in a research site than it is being in a clinical practice. So we're very scientific here. We're going to treat the research participant with respect and concern, but not with over empathy and analysis. Like, we're not going to give them tools to improve their symptoms because we want to see if the medication alone will help improve their symptoms of whatever got them into the study, like for bipolar or mania or depression, rather than our clinical care. So, there are various reasons for placebo and nocebo effect. And so what we've done is there a way to mitigate placebo response by addressing those reasons for those placebo and nocebo effect? So what do I mean? One primary reason, which I hinted at a few minutes ago, of the placebo effect is expectation bias. Not only from us, the site has expectations because, for example, and let me know if I'm talking too much, Luke.
No, this is incredible. Please go on.
Thank you. We go to what they call investigator meetings. So the investigator meeting, or the IM, that's where they tell us about the study. Mm-hmm. We all get together in a room, and the pharmaceutical company says, okay, here's that protocol, which I mentioned earlier, and here are the rules for the study. That's where we learn about the rules. Then after the IM, we come back and conduct the study. But at the IM, they try to get us excited. That's why they're doing the study. They found that at some level, this compound, this medical compound, can be somewhat effective. Mm-hmm. And so we may leave being excited about the compound, and either consciously or subconsciously, we relay that excitement to the research participant. And that forms an expectation bias. The other thing, the site is a bit pressured. I'm going to be realistic here. The site's a bit pressured to enroll because we told the sponsor, yes, we will put 8 subjects or participants in your study, or 20 participants. And so we have to, on some level, communicate to the participant that this might be helpful so they can participate. So it's a fine balance between not having that overt expectation relayed onto the participant. Now, the participant also has an expectation. Why else am I coming into this study if I'm not going to improve? How about all the commercials that they see in the U.S.? This drug helps, this new drug helps, and so on. So that's why they want to participate in the study. There's another sort of reason for a placebo and nocebo effect, and that's called conditioning, what we call classical conditioning. It's basically, what that means is your previous experience mm-hmm. will predict your future experience. So let's say a participant was in a clinical trial a year ago, and they felt helped. Maybe they were even on an actual active compound, but we don't know. But they did feel helped. For whatever reason, they felt it was effective. Now they're in a new research study, and they bring that experience onto the new clinical trial. And so what we want to do is communicate and teach the participant these biases, expectation bias, the conditioning, how they're going to be treated differently than their psychiatrist, than their primary care physician treats them, or their therapist. So we developed a script. It's called the Placebo Control Reminder Script. And we read it to each participant at each visit, so not only the first visit and not only the last visit, but all the study visits, and we tell them, it takes about a minute to review with them, no expectations, their job is to tell us the truth, we're not going to be disappointed if they're better, worse, or the same. We remind them continuously that they may be on an active medication or the placebo. We don't know what they're on. They don't know what they're on. And we don't even know if the active medication is helpful. And finally, what we say in the script is, while we're going to treat you with respect and concern, we're not going to be overly warm and fuzzy like your therapist was. Like, I'm a licensed psychologist. When I was in private practice, I would do everything in my power to make them feel better. But as a scientist, right, in a clinical study, I can't do that. I can't pat them on the back. I can't say, oh, you can do this. I can't do that. I have to be neutral.
Right.
And so we tell them that. We don't want them to think we're being rude when we're doing sort of our assessments. And what we found in brief is that when we review these factors, what we call placebo response factors, with the participant, they significantly have less placebo response than those individuals who did not get the script. And so we find there's something there in that communication between the site and the research participant.
The theme that comes across to me in this is really putting that patient first, listening to what the patient is saying, observing what the patient is going through, and again, really being present at the moment with that individual. It kind of reminds me of that integrated experience. You know, you run into a room and you looked panicked. Everyone else all of a sudden feels panicked. Or if you walk into a room and you're playing music and dancing, then it, you know, you can project very easily upon others your expectations. And I can imagine that all of those different components are vital in trying to reduce that placebo effect. And like you said, we'll never probably get to zero. I mean, obviously, when you look at cancer and heart disease and other measurable type of indications that you can look at cellular regrowth or destruction, that's much different than whenever you're dealing with symptoms of the mind, right? I mean, these are starkly different, and your approaches have to be different as well. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. And I know that many times people are apprehensive about entering a clinical research trial. They're not quite sure what their expectations are, what the safety is, and so forth. But, you know, from talking to a lot of clinical researchers and a lot of people who've gone through a clinical research trial, there are a lot of positive things that can happen for an individual. There are a lot of good things that can come about as being a participant. Can you talk a little bit about maybe what are some of the positive aspects of entering a clinical research trial for an individual?
Great question. So important. Thank you. So we know from research that about 10% of Americans do participate in clinical trials. Clearly, we do need that to be increased. We want new individuals to join. So we're not having this constant repeat of participants. There's pros and cons to that, certainly, which we can talk about if you want, but we definitely want new folks. And so what you get from being in a clinical trial, I think certainly is access to experts in the field. I can't tell you, I actually just had it this morning. Somebody came in, and this happens almost every day, Luke, where they come in and this person says, I'm diagnosed with bipolar, schizophrenia, PTSD, anxiety, and a whole list of, and I'm like, okay, let's start with bipolar. What's your understanding of bipolar? I don't know. I've been told I'm bipolar. They don't understand the symptoms. How do you begin to treat yourself to get better if you don't understand your own symptoms? And I'm not blaming the patient.
Right.
It's really our fault. It's not our industry. It's the clinical field's fault, and they're not to blame either because they're swamped. These patients, many come from community mental health centers, and they are overwhelmed. The psychiatrist literally has 5 minutes to see someone. How are they going to explain the illness? And then the therapist, for various reasons, isn't explaining the disorder to them. So I sit down and we explain, okay, this is what mania is. This is what depression is. This is what mood stability looks like. This is why you were on lithium. This is why you were on Depakote or Seroquel. And not to be narcissistic, because trust me, look, I have low self-esteem, but they come out saying, oh my God, nobody ever told me that.
Wow.
That's why I have that. That's why I bought the $1,000 worth of, you know, appliances. That's why I go into various
things. Right.
But they didn't know why they did that. That's why I couldn't go to work. I had that symptom. I was depressed. So that's priceless. The other thing is what we do in many of our sites, certainly our site and other sites, is we provide free care. If you participate in our studies, we're not just at the end of the visit going to say sayonara. We're going to say, okay, let's get you back on previous medication that either worked for you, or if some of them were not optimal, let's try a new medication, and we'll provide free care. At our site, we do 6 different sessions of free care, of psychiatric sessions. Of course, we're not rigid and only 6. If you need more assistance, we can provide that. By the way, the other thing that we do, and a lot of sites I would imagine do this, is when this, as a patient, because they're not research participants yet, come in mm-hmm. to get evaluated, to get into a study, we take their blood pressure. We may take their HbA1c. We'll take their height and weight to get their BMI. And if, for example, their blood pressure is off the chains, off the roof, we'll say, look, we can give you some medication to help with that, HCTZ, lisinopril, amlodipine, et cetera. They'll see one of our physicians, and we'll treat them, bring them back next week. Now we've controlled their blood pressure. Same thing with HbA1c. Start them on metformin or insulin or what have you. Thinking of other, certainly just the ideology of being part of science,
right.
Part of helping other people in clinical trials in the future deal with that condition.
Mm-hmm.
I think that speaks volumes as well as to why somebody would want to join. By the way, a lot of our studies are what they call open label. So that whole placebo versus active medication, that's about 90% of clinical trials, but a good 10%, anecdotally, of studies are open label. You're guaranteed to get the medication. So that may be an alternative for people who can't get scheduled for community mental health centers or to see a psychiatrist, and to see if that open label medication actually helps.
You guys are doing some incredible progressive work at Hassman Research Institute. And I just want to say it's been a great pleasure to sit down with you today. I know that we had a lot of other things we wanted to go over, and I would love to have you back at another time to talk. Extremely informative. No, this has been extremely informative. I think that the listeners would appreciate such detail and mostly going into that placebo and nocebo effect. I mean, I guess it's hard to understand all the dynamics that can come into play that impacts the data and the research that's going on. And obviously, you want to have a clear understanding whether or not a specific compound is helping someone with the symptoms or experiencing, and all the dynamics that go on in the clinical research study, which makes this area, right, the central nervous system research area, very unique compared to other indications.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. Well, listen, I want to thank you for being here today. Dr. Cohen, it's been a great pleasure, and we would love to have you back to talk further.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity, and kudos to the STAR Coalition. Real quick, I'm a huge fan. We all should be a huge fan of your crucial mission, as well as your amazing, dedicated your kind, dedicated staff. It's wonderful working with you.
Well, listen, it's a pleasure to work with people like you that are on the front lines of progressive scientific research. And again, what you're doing is incredible.
Thank you.
Dr. Cohen is the lead psychometric rater and principal investigator for Hassman Research Institute. You guys can visit their website at HRITrials.com, HRITrials.com. Learn more about the incredible work they're doing. Boy, it's what a great pleasure to talk with you. Again,
this is
Luke Kramer. We love to come together to meet with thought leaders like Dr. Cohen to discuss topics which we know affect each and every one of us. Be sure to follow the Star Coalition on social media and our website at www.thestarr.org. And we look forward to meeting with you guys again. Join us every now and then as we meet with other thought leaders and stay in touch with the great work that the Star is doing and also with the partners and coalition members that are just changing the shape and face of research. Thank you again, and we will see you guys soon.